My Secular Sobriety is a podcast that gives voice to secular people who are overcoming addiction and unhealthy behaviors through reason, learning, and community. It's good to be back recording another episode. It's been a little while. Today's guest is Danny Castro, who was recommended to us by our friend Gabe Rosales, who you may remember was on episode 9. Gabe gave me a very brief description of Danny's story, and I found it compelling, and I was excited that he agreed to appear on our podcast. So, hey Danny, welcome to My Secular Sobriety.
Hey John.
It's good to have you here.
Good to be here.
So, Gabe just gave me kind of a very brief summary. He said that your story was I can't remember how he put it, but he didn't say compelling, but he said, maybe we said it was insane. He said it was insane. So,
I think every alcoholic story is probably insane, huh? Yeah.
There's always some insanity in there, I think. Yeah, for sure. There was a mine I think you're right. Let's start, if you don't mind, if you could give us a little bit of background about yourself and, you know, your upbringing and when you started drinking, when it became a problem, and we'll just kind of go from there.
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in a pretty religious household, and drinking alcohol, and it's very, very conservative, very fundamentalist kind of thing. And so drinking was considered a sin and all this and that. It didn't bother me any. I had never tried drinking anyway, so I just went along with whatever. But around 16, I'd say, I started questioning some of the teachings that I was being taught. And I would just tell my parents and whoever were the teachers at the church, you know, where does it say you can't drink? I don't know. I think drinking was – they made a big deal about drinking. So – and I had never drank, and I didn't know anybody that drank. I just found it curious that they had this really strong teaching, and then they couldn't back it up necessarily in the Bible or whatever. And I've always been that kind of guy that questions everything since like second grade. The Bible, it paints some negative pictures of drinking, but there was nowhere where it necessarily said it's a sin or something, whatever. Even though it might have said some other strong language like drunkards go to hell or something. But anyways, it wasn't good enough for me or whatever. And so I told myself that at 21 I would drink if I wanted to. So I did at 21. We were in New York City for a family vacation, and me and my brothers went to a bar, and it was a comedy thing, and I ordered a Heineken and a Coke, and I just thought that might have been a drink because I didn't know. I had never drank before, so I thought it was going to be something like a Jack and Coke or something, but I said Heineken and Coke. So the lady just looked at me kind of weird and brought a Heineken and a Coke, and what I did was I thought it was weird that she didn't pour the Heineken in the Coke because I thought that's what. So I drank half the Coke, and then I poured half of the Heineken into the Coke. Anyways.
You really didn't know how to drink, did you?
No, man. And I was 21, and I thought it was gross, and I was like, oh, I wonder why people do this, whatever. Anyways, I went on tour shortly after. I was 21, 22. I went on tour with this band that just loved drinking, and I still wasn't a big drinker. So, you know, this guy, the drummer, what was the patch? He's actually the drummer now of Delta Spirit. And so we were on tour, and him and I would be drinking all the time, but this guy would drink, you know, 4 beers at a time in the morning, and I would drink like half a beer, and I'd be wondering, geez, how does this thinking? But by the end of the tour, I was just having a lot of fun, you know? So I got home, and then the partying began. But it wasn't that crazy. I remember having weeks where I might drink 2 beers or something for the whole week and go out drinking one night and only have 2 beers. But everything, so I was 22, 23, 24, that kind of party lifestyle, little by little got worse and worse, but near any kind of alcoholic levels, it was still, you know, manageable. It wasn't even a question. But when I turned 25, I had a panic attack. And I didn't know anybody that had panic attacks or anxiety or any kind of depression issues. I pretty much grew up in a bubble. And the panic attack, it completely destroyed my life. It was sitting upside down. I couldn't make sense of anything. I was terrified. In the morning, woke up. I mean, what happened was when I went drinking one night, went home, fell asleep. The next day, I was just walking around sober, and I just had a panic attack for no reason, just completely terrified. And I went to the hospital, and they said nothing was wrong with me, that it was probably a panic attack. And I asked them what that was, and they just said, you know, you just got you something, whatever it is. Anyways, I kept having panic attacks after that for, you know, in the morning. And it's it feels like if you're like if somebody scares you, comes up from behind you and scares you and gets you good, but it's just for no reason, and it's and it lasts for a while, like it could be an hour or something, and it just feels like you're terrified, like that initial jolt of, you know, someone just scared me, that happens. And then it just lasts. Like if you're in a war zone or something, you're terrified. I imagine I've never been in a war zone, so I shouldn't use that analogy. But any scary situation where maybe you're in a fight. I mean, I have many scary situations now that I've been to prison and stuff. But it's just a feeling of terror. And you think you're going to die. You think you're having a heart attack. You think you're – I had crazy ideas. I would go to the hospital and say, hey, I think my brain's too big. Like, what does that even mean? It's just you start thinking of crazy things. Oh, my heart's too big. My brain's too big. You know, I'm not breathing. And they're like, you're not breathing. I'm like, no, I'm positive. I'm not breathing. I'm going to die or something. And so that started happening regularly. And I think I'm never sure, but I think it was something that had happened when I had a cough a couple months earlier. And it was kind of like a recall of the terror, because I had this cough and it closed my throat up and I couldn't breathe when I went in, and I got scared. I had that scary feeling. And it was just like that a month or so later when I had my first panic attack. Anyways, I went to the doctors, and I was too scared to take any medications for panic attacks, or, you know, they try to give you Xanax or depression meds. I just didn't want, I was too scared. The panic attacks kind of make you scared of everything, including medicine. And so I resorted to the thing I knew that made me feel good. So that's the alcohol. And that's when I started drinking in the morning to take care of the panic attacks, and at night all the time. So I was in a band at this point, and we were touring a bit.
Did the alcohol take it off, take them away?
Yeah, it was, to me, it was a miracle, right? Because, like I said, I wasn't drinking before that panic attack. One mornings, I wasn't even thinking about it. I'd wait till the weekends or whatever it was. And now that I had these panic attacks for about 2 weeks, I wasn't drinking because I thought, oh, I don't want to make it worse. But then when I saw that the panics weren't going to go away, I was like, there's no way I can make this worse by drinking. Little did I know, because it was going to get far worse, but because of the drinking. But at the time, it did work. I drank, you know, like a beer or two in the morning, and I thought, wow, like I can actually live my, because now I don't have panic. Like the fear is gone. I'm feeling good and buzzed. But as you know, as any alcoholic knows, you know, two beers might work the first time and in the morning, but then you got to have, I was starting to have 8 or 9 or 10 before noon. And of course I was touring and I was in college at the same time. So I'm 25, 26, 27 around there. And I'm not managing it well. I don't take college. I would take a 40 to school in the morning. So when I'd start feeling the withdrawals or the shakiness, I would head to the bathroom with my backpack and you know, down the 40, go back to class. Then I'd have to drive home. And then, so I couldn't do well in college. We had to stop touring because I'd be blacking out. Like if I had a 20-day tour set up, I'd be blacked out and falling off the stage during the first show, like in Arizona or somewhere, before the tour even really got started. And we'd have to turn around and bring me home because there was no way I was going to, you know, finish the tour. I was getting blacked out. I didn't remember the first show. And I asked the guys, like, hey, what's going on? And they, the next morning, as I'm drinking, they'd say, hey, man, you blacked out after the first song and you fell off the stage after the first song, you know, when we had to play like an hour. And I'd be like, oh, I can do the rest. You know, I'll take it easy. And no, of course not. So they would turn around. And my band has a couple of my brothers in the band, so siblings. So, you know, they're not going to put up with any shit. They're just going to be like, we got to go home. They're not going to let the singer kind of bulldoze the situation. So I was finally on 28. I stopped playing in the band so much. And I started, that's when I started realizing, man, I think I'm killing myself with the drinking. Because up to that point, between and 28, I started, that's when I was drinking in the mornings and just getting blacked out every day. And for, you know, 6 months straight, I'm drunk, and then 2 weeks off, and then, you know, trying to fight it off. So finally I was trying to take school seriously, at least to get a foothold and maybe do the band after school or something after I got a bachelor's. So I barely finished college at 30 years old with a lot of drunk kind of episodes that were just bad. You know, like I would have a couple months sobriety, and then within 3 days I would end up at a sober house or something. And at one of those times, my parents actually took me to Mexico, where, because here, you know, once you're sober, you can walk out of the sober house because we have, you know, certain rights. Well, in Mexico, once you get committed to one of these places, you can't get out. It's more like a little prison or whatever. And so I ended up at this one place that was hell. I mean, they wouldn't let me drink water for 4 days because they were like drying me out or something. And they said that, my liver could explode if I drank water. And I was like, man, I really don't think that's true. I was fucking dying there. Oh, sorry.
That's okay. You can cuss. That's okay. Here, but, no, you can. This is so, explicitly rated, so it's fine.
Yeah, so okay, good. And it's secular, right? I mean, nobody,
yeah, no one cares.
But so man, I had some seizures in there at the Mexico place. I had seizures and just hallucinations while I was awake, and I was just dying for some water. And they were giving me like this pinch of vodka every couple of hours because they thought, yeah, they thought, oh, you know, we should wean them off the alcohol by giving me, it was scalding hot. I couldn't even drink it, right? Because I was like, oh, great, I'm going to have a little bit of vodka. And it was so scalding hot that I couldn't drink it. And so I would hold on to it till it got warm. And as soon as it was warm, they took it away and gave me a scalding one.
Oh, my God.
I don't know. I have no idea how
these guys were sadistic. They weren't wanting you to get better.
I thought I was going to die, man. There was no like medical facility there and having seizures. I didn't sleep for 4 days. Everything was bad. And then finally on the fourth day, they gave me water and then some kind of shot. I mean, by that point, I didn't care what they did to me, but they brought out a needle and they gave me a shot of vitamins, supposedly. And someone popped up like a Xanax out of nowhere. And I'm like, where was this stuff in the beginning, man? But so I finished college at 30 and I applied to graduate schools right away. I was going to do a master's. So I got accepted to Rutgers up on in the East Coast, New Jersey. And it's, you know, I think I can stay sober because I'm going to be at a really good program working on a master's or whatever in English. And they were like, okay, you know, you seem to be doing good. I was sober for a month or something. And and I packed up all my belongings in one car, and drove, and I got to Arizona, like not that far, drinking there, and ended up getting arrested in Flagstaff. And so I spent the night in jail, and then the next day they just let me go and said, oh, we'll see you in court or something, because it was they just pulled me over and I was drunk or something. So then I drove and I told myself, man, I got to stay sober. So I made it all the way to St. Louis to a friend's house there, and I got blacked out there, and I ended up in the hospital. Just, I don't know, you know how it goes, probably drinking, and then you wake up in the hospital. And then they wanted me to turn around, right? They were like, you got to go home. And I was like, no, I got to go to school. So then I get to sobered up for whatever, 3 days as I drove to Jersey. And then I got there, and the first night I met some roommates and I got hammered. And the next day I woke up with a bunch of beers around me, you know, in my new room. Half empty beers and closed beers, and there was a fridge full of beer. And I just asked myself, man, if I stay here and I try to do school like this on the East Coast without any family around, I'm not going to do well. I'm probably going to die here. So I was looking at my favorite thing to do in the morning was to just look for half empty beers and drink them all. So I looked at that beer in my hand and I was like, man, I got to go back home. So I put it down. And I drove back to back home. And on my way back home, I emailed a famous Rutgers professor in philosophy. And I asked him, hey, man, I told him, hey, I'm driving home because I'm an alcoholic and I can't do this out here. And I was like, I was really looking forward to sitting in your classes. And he put in a word for me in L.A. at this school to do my master in philosophy over there. So I was switching over from English to philosophy. And with his word alone, kind of reached out to him and connected and was honest about, hey, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm barely staying alive out here. He kind of put a word in, and I drove straight to LA to start the program in a week or something. So I get there and I start the program, Masters in Philosophy. And I lasted about 2 semesters. You know, I was living in my car, just getting hammered at the end of the night. I wasn't doing well, you know, just kind of barely playing the part there. So, I'd go to class, I'd go back to my car, I'd drive around, and then I'd go get some bottles of Jack and get ready for the night just so I could go to sleep at night. And, I mean, one night I ended up outside the car in my boxers, something passed out on the grass in front of the school. Cops show up, meet at the drunk tank, and then I come back, I get out, and I'm like, sitting in my car in the middle of the night, you know, when I was released from junk tank, just wondering like what's going to happen to me. So right around that time, I got a show in San Diego with a band called the Flowbots to open up for them. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to go do this one quick show. And that was the night, May 22nd, 2012, I think. I think so. So I went and played the show. I had been drinking, you know, the last couple of weeks. And at the show, my brothers weren't playing. I got a couple other musicians to play with me. I'm the singer, so I just kind of picked some guys that didn't know my drinking too much, you know. And played, met this girl that I keep in touch with to this day. And just got blacked out. And the other guys went home because they drove separately. And I was there at the show with the instruments and the car and by myself. Supposedly, I was waiting to get paid at the end of the night. But really, I was just wanted everybody that I knew to leave so I could drink without anybody, you know, looking at me that knew me. So it was a sold-out show. And I was just, you know, living that life where, you know, you play a show, a lot of people there, and just party, got drunk, blacked out. Last thing I remember was having shots with the management of a bar. It must've been past 2 or something. And then they said, that was it. I drank, was doing shots at the end of the night. I black out. I wake up in the hospital, and I was told that I was in a car accident. I think the officer was telling me that I killed somebody accident, but I didn't know what that meant. I'd never been to prison. I was like, okay, so what do we do next? And he said, well, you're going to county, and then you can bail out, and you'll have to deal with this in court. So it was unreal. So I bail out, and I find out that there's I hit another car, apparently. I don't remember any of it. They said I hit another car and that the other people almost died, but apparently nobody did die. They were just very, very injured. It was a grave injury or whatever. Nothing happened to me in the car accident. I think maybe a bruise or something, but apparently I flipped my car over. It was 2 or 3 in the morning. Hit the other car, almost killed them. And that was it. And they gave me 9 years, 8 months for that because of, it was a third DUI. And there was what they call a great bodily injury. So kept drinking. I just couldn't stop drinking. I mean, it was so illogical, right? And I think we all. Yeah. And even before, while I was dealing with my court stuff, you would think that after so many weird, hard things, whether it was Mexico or just my parents being dragged through hell this whole time drinking, and just weird other things that happened to me, you know, as I was hanging out with people that were just totally messed up on drugs on the streets, stuff that I haven't mentioned in this story, but you know, everyone has these weird stories of just being blacked out and waking up somewhere and not knowing what happened. None of that was getting me to stop. So I'm going to court. I'm not stopping. I get sentenced. And now I'm like, whoa, 9 years. I can't believe I'm out, by the way. It's crazy. I just got out 3 months ago. Yeah, thank you. And it was crazy when they give you 9 years. It's if no one's been to prison, it's crazy if they give you 1 year. I was giving 1 year. 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 9 years at 85%, which means, you know, they only knock off 15% as opposed to halftime or something. So I'm terrified. And even that wasn't enough. And I get to prison and I'm drinking there. Within the first 2 months, I was just getting hammered. And one night, within the first 3 months or so of prison, I get blacked out, and apparently, so I'm in the area of prison known as the GP, which just means that that's where all the gang activity is. Really, it's the other side is called protective custody, right? So I'm in the regular GP because that's just where there was no issue with me being there. So apparently, one night I'm blacked out on prison wine, which you just make wherever in a big trash bag full of rotten fruit or whatever and sugar, and you just ferment it. And you can make it every 3 days or so. And I black out, and apparently the last thing I remember was doing meth, right? I've never done meth. I've never really done drugs in general, not even weed or anything. So I'm doing meth. Don't know why. I was just blacked out, and apparently I had ordered it from what they call a shot call, lead gang members of the Mexican crew. I had called them over, and $25 worth of meth. I mean, there's everything in prison. I think my cellmate had been asking me to do it or something, and we were both drunk. So I do it, and that was it, man. That was December 6, 2014, I think. It was pure hell. It took away the drunk right away, and I was just grinding my teeth, and I couldn't breathe for about 8 hours. I was struggling to breathe, of just like catching my breath. It was painful. It was, I mean, terrifying. I thought I was going to die. It was like all the panic attacks I'd ever had, all rolled up into one massive panic attack that lasted about 8 hours. And I was yelling for help, and I was losing my mind, and I was getting in trouble with the gang members because they don't really like attention being called, someone's freaking out on drugs or something. It's going to make the whole area look bad. Like, oh, they're selling drugs in here. Now we got to go search everybody's cells or something. But I didn't So I finally, the cops came and they took me down to the nurse and they're asking me, are you on drugs or something? And I said, no, I'm just having a PTSD, you know, flashback or something. And I need anything to help me. And they checked my vitals. And apparently they were scared enough to give me Xanax. It was Adderall, but you know, that's essentially or whatever. And when they told me they were going to give me Xanax, I was just like, oh man, I'm going to be fine in like 40 minutes. So they gave me a big dose and in 40 minutes I was good. I fell asleep, but they took me back to the cell and that was it, man. That was the last time I drank. That was towards the beginning of my prison sentence. And then from there, you know, you get moved around prisons. I ended up only doing 5 years because I earned Prop 57 passed. It was a law here in California. And I earned that let you earn time off your sentence by doing school and a bunch of other stuff. But I ended up doing three AA degrees, another bachelor's degree, and a master's degree, all within like 3 years or something. And I ended up getting about like off or more. And so I ended up doing about 5.5 years in prison. And there was alcohol everywhere.
Did you go to any kind of support group or anything while you're in there? Or did you just stop on your own?
Yeah. I stopped on my own at first because I think the way I describe it was I had a certain trauma, like a PTSD moment that led me to drinking, which was the breathing thing I had mentioned. I couldn't breathe that one day and I ended up having a panic attack. So that pushed me towards drinking because I didn't know it. I wasn't well informed enough to find a different answer. And then the thing that pushed me out of drinking was another trauma, which was this 8-hour panic attack that was a direct result from drinking because the drinking led to the meth. And so there was a trauma that pushed me into drinking and there was a trauma that pushed me out of drinking because drinking was no longer an option because I thought, well, now I can't fix my problems with drinking because it might lead to a meth because that's just the kind of addict alcoholic I am that, you know, once I'm drunk, hey, let's look for more stuff. And so I was left with nothing essentially as far as what could help me with my panic attacks. Cause I was still having panic attacks in prison, as you can imagine. And, that's not the reason I didn't search, you know, AA or any help. The reason was in the beginning in prison, you're in a prison called reception. And that's where you wait to be assigned to another prison. And I was there for 8 months. So I was drinking for the first 3 months. And then for the next 5 months, it's like the hole. And so there's no AA, there's nothing for you. Then I got moved to a level 4 prison for another couple months. And there's nothing at level 4 prisons. Most of the time, there's no AA, there's no church. So couldn't get any help there. And then they moved me to a level 3, but that level 3 at Salinas was, it was more like a level 4 that was, they told me we're moving you to a level 3, but it's actually a level 4 that's starting to transition into a level 3. And those kind of transitions just take forever, man. So I was there for about 2 years and there was nothing. There was an AA program there, but the waiting list was like 6 months. There was church, but it was always packed out. And there was like, there was no help.
Is a level 4 like maximum security? And then level 3 would like be more like medium or minimum security?
So the SHU, something they call SHU, is like, I'd be like the maxed out, other than like death row. It goes death row, then it goes the SHU, which is just essentially the hole, like being locked up. And then level 4 is right after that. And there's just minimal yards and everything. That's the maximum. That's level 4 is the maximum for a regular yard. And then level 3 is still pretty high, especially on the GP side. There's still riots and gangs and all this. Even on the what they call the SNY side, it's really hard. Level 3 is, it's like all the level 4 guys that are barely getting out. So it's still pretty rough. And then level 2 finally is pretty calm. And then level 1 is its own crazy thing because it's just got a bunch of knuckleheads there that are doing like 6 months time. And so everyone's fighting in level 1 and doing drugs on level 1. I think level 2 is like the most peaceful one, surprisingly. surprisingly. So I go through finally, and that's where I met Gabe Rosales down there at RJD. And there it was just so many programs. And I was doing about 22 and a half hours of self-help stuff. I just joined. So I was there at RJD. And that's when I really started that self-help, anything that I could get into. But I mean, at that point, I'd been sober, and I had cellmates that were making wine or White Lightning and hard alcohol and everything, doing drugs, shooting up right there next to me. And there was just nothing you can do. You know, you're either going to somehow find some kind of footing to stay sober, or you're going to die and the prison system's not going to help you.
Yeah. Okay. So you were going to that, and then you're out now, and how are things going today?
Yeah, I'm out. Everybody in prison, they fantasize about getting out, and they think it's going to be one thing. They think it's going to be a certain thing, a certain great thing. And it is great to be out, but it was far different than I thought it was going to be. I'm fortunate. I have family that was waiting for me and a place to live, and, a friend gave me a job, and I was good to go. But it was the first day was really, in prison, we make fun of each other, the people that are sober. We make fun of each other, and we say, oh, yeah, when you get out, you're probably going to be one of those guys that just starts drinking again. And we all deny it. We all go, no, man, I'm the real deal. I've been sober 5 years. Oh, I've been sober 3 years. I've been sober 10 years. And then we still give each other a hard time. It is, the humor in prison is really dark, as you can imagine. Sometimes your friend commits suicide and find some way to, live in this dark humor, I guess. But so in my, I was like, I could never drink again. Like, I can't imagine coming back to prison and doing it again. So of course I'm not going to drink. And when you're in prison, it seems like the most obvious thing that you will not drink. And then you get out and you realize how easy it is to drink, but not only the access to the alcohol, because there's alcohol in prison, but there's a certain flow of life that you forgot about while you were in prison that just can easily sweep you up into a bar, or, you haven't hung out with women. So, maybe a woman wants to come over and have some wine. And it's just so normal that after like the third or fourth day when I got out, I was like in shock. I was like, wow, I can see myself drinking. Like I would totally explain it away. I could just see myself going down to the liquor store and having one or two, 24s or something. And I thought, wow, this is why guys drink, because it's not necessarily their fault. But if you don't have something figured out, and I don't want to say figured out because that makes it sound like you figured it out and you're better than the guy that's still drinking. And that's not the case. I think something else happens where you're just fortunate and you're just not drinking anymore. Something happened either in the brain or... to this day, I still don't know what it is that has kept me sober. But no, I haven't drank even when I got out. But I definitely saw how easy blames. And some of my friends got out and they started drinking already and getting blacked out and doing whatever. And I'm just like, I'm bummed out. But I totally understand how when you get out, it's just this big place that you think you're going to be fine. But anyways, yeah, I started a second master's degree up at Cal State LA. So that's my main thing. And then I work with a buddy in comic books as a writer, and, hanging out with my parents, who are happy to have me sober and home, hang out doing the band with my brothers. And, yeah, like I said, it's been 3 months and I've just been really productive and, happy to stay sober. It doesn't seem easier or harder than before. It just seems like a thing that I think about every day. And some people are surprised by that, but I guess they don't understand. They ask, do you think about drinking? And I go, yeah, every day, when I wake up, I dream about it. When I wake up and then during the day, when I'm on a jog and I see a bottle of beer that's half empty and I could just like I mean, that's what I would do if back in the day, if I saw a bottle in the middle of the street and he still had beer, I'd just grab it and drink it. Free beer.
So did you learn to deal with those?
Out here, I guess I'm still learning, but I think meditation in some weird way. I started going to AA, obviously, right when I got out, but they closed that down for quarantine or whatever.
Oh, that's right, yeah. I'm going to have to ask you a couple questions about that, by the way. So.
Okay, good. And then, I'd say some kind of mix between like meditation and working out or something, as far as not drinking out here. And the reason I say that is because I equate jogging. I jog a lot, like 10 miles a day or whatever it might be. I equate that with meditation. And meditation, all I mean by that is, all I mean personally by that is I think about it. I think about my feelings as I'm jogging. And then when I see a bottle and I want it, I ask myself, I go through every scenario and I go, you know, if you want to die, you can do that. If you don't want to die, you don't do that. And if you're okay with dying, maybe there's a better way to die and instead of drinking, and just weird thoughts, like philosophical thoughts on and on about death, about drinking, about love, about life, to the point where I go, you know what? I'm okay. I'm okay right now. That's going to bring me far more suffering, and just hold on. And if there's a moment where you really want it, just hold on an hour or two. You're not going to want it that bad later on. And
I really relate to what you're saying.
Dream
I got into meditation. I'm not so good about doing it now, but gosh, what was it, 20 some years ago or whatever. And what I learned from the meditation was how to let go of my thoughts, that I didn't have to grab onto them. And also running. I always equated that with meditation. I love running, and I haven't been doing that much lately either. But when I would run, the thing about that is that after a while, your body just kind of gets into a groove, you know, and it's like, it seems like you're not putting the effort. When I'd first start running, in the beginning of the run, it seemed like, God damn. But after a certain period of time, it just kind of flows. And then my mind just kind of, I would think about things like you were saying. I'd solve some problem while I'm running, you know, it's great.
Yeah, I love it. And of course it shoots, you know, makes you feel good at the end of the run.
Yeah, yeah.
The endorphins or whatever it is.
Yeah. So, are you still playing music? Are you in a band?
Yeah. I'm in the band. We're recording and stuff, and just, you know, hoping to play some shows in LA probably when things open up. Other than that,
it's kind of hard now, I guess, in the music business to actually, you can't really perform.
Yeah, totally interesting, isn't it?
Yeah,
and I don't think that's going to be a normal thing for a while now. Maybe late next year or something.
I don't think so either. I think I asked Gabe the same question. When you do get back out to performing, do you think it's going to be different sober? Do you think it's going to be a problem?
Not for me personally, but only because I've been playing live since I was 11. And then I started touring and even playing in my rock bands at 16. It was always sober. It was always sober all the way to 21. And even, so I was already playing for a long time.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was very normal for me.
Yeah. Now I got to ask you about AA. Did you have any problems with it?
Yeah.
With AA? And what did you like and what did you not like?
Before prison, I never really got it because I didn't consider myself an alcoholic. And then on December 6, 2014, when I finally had this long-lasting sobriety, the first thing I told myself was, after doing the meth, right, and taking the Xanax and being able to go to sleep and waking up, that day, December 6th, I asked myself, well, what am I going to do? Going to drink again and go through that again? And I was so fucking desperate to get sober that I said, I will say and do anything to stay sober. And that day I said, I don't care. It was like the hardest thing to call myself an alcoholic, right? my whole drinking career, I was trying to not call myself an alcoholic. People would call me an alcoholic. I'd go to AA meetings because of the first and second DUI. And I'd be telling them, oh, well, I'm not an alcoholic. I just messed up this time or whatever. So for whatever reason, I was always fighting that name, that type, that identity. And that day when I stopped drinking, I completely took that name upon myself. And I called myself an alcoholic, and it was extremely helpful to me. Now, I didn't know much about AA at the time, but then as I went to a couple meetings, it was apparent that that was something like the first step, right? And hold on, I'm recording. So that was the first step, apparently. And I'm not too familiar with it even now because, like I said, I did the first 3 years in prison without access to AA. And then at Donovan, where I met Gabe, there was some, but their main program was, their main substance abuse program was not based on AA. It was based on something else. They called it substance abuse treatment or something. It was more with cognitive behavior.
Yeah, like smart recovery.
Or something. Right. And that's kind of more what they were doing at RJB. Perfect. So two things though, that I did take away from AA that I kind of found completely fit exactly what I was thinking was the first step and the 12th step. And even now I'm not as familiar to know them like word by word, but to get to some place where you can say, I'm an alcoholic is near impossible. And a lot of people die before they can like get to this weird identity. And now I'm super proud of anyone that I'm an alcoholic and it's a thing for me. I just love that it helps me stay sober. But the 12th step was like the, you know, if you forget to help, it's dangerous for yourself, helpful to help. Yeah, I've always helped, found it helpful to help others. And as far as the rest of it, I don't think I'm familiar enough with it. From what I've heard, you know, the statistics aren't that great for alcoholics in general or drug addicts. Even I think that the statistics are so bad, even for people that do AA perfectly. I think I forget what the numbers are, but it's like AA had like the best. And even that small thing was like the best thing possible for a long time. And I read this book called Beautiful Boy.
Oh, you know, I've got the book,
and,
but I've never read it.
Author kept in touch with me a little bit. Okay, cool. And the author, he kept in touch with me a little bit as I sent him a couple emails after reading the book. And he's somebody that, I mean, in the book, he talks about this, how there's just been no research. There's been not enough scientific research on alcoholism and addiction. It's just been stigmatized. And our choice as a country and as a world, we're just like, hey, let's punish people for when they drink too much instead of trying to figure out how to stop drinking or whatever. Yeah, but do you have any questions about specifically about what I might think about AA?
No, not really. Not really. Not really. I was the only reason I asked and I was curious is because so my story, and I won't take too long with this, but so I was 25 years old when I got sober, and for me it was that third DUI and losing my job and just life was a mess, and the only place I knew to go was AA. So I went to AA. And I didn't really identify as an atheist or anything. I was okay with, you know, but the God stuff kind of, what I did with that, I just kind of said, it bothered me, but I just kind of set it aside, you know? And for 25 years, I set it aside until I couldn't anymore. And then I kind of came in conflict with some people and conflict with AA in general, but I've kind of worked that out now. So, but yeah, so that was kind of my story there. And it was just
the conflict, if you don't mind me asking.
Well, the conflict was that what I found myself doing, Danny, is I found myself conforming to what I thought the group would expect me to say and do. So you learn the language in AA, there's a certain language. And I learned to talk the way so that people would approve of what I was saying. After a long time of doing that, I realized, you know what? This isn't me. And I started talking about my recovery in more practical terms. And I kind of, I don't have use for the term higher power and all this kind of stuff that they have in AA. And it wasn't accepted by a lot of people. And they insisted that I had to have a higher power, that I had to have something other than human beings. And it was a really weird situation, because once I stopped conforming, these people who I knew for so long, I found out that they really didn't accept me for who I was, the way I was. So anyway, what I did is I started another AA group that was secular, and that took care of that problem. So, but now I'm interested in things other than AA.
I can totally relate to that, because growing up, I was taught about a certain way that God was supposed to be, or the higher power or whatever. And it was just like, ask and you just get whatever you ask for. And that kind of thing. Or if you're in bad things won't happen to you, and if it's happened to you, it's because you're not a good Christian or something. These are the ideas I grew up with. And so, yeah. And now as a philosopher, or someone working on a master's in philosophy and talking to a bunch of philosophers, whether they're theists or atheists, my thought is, if God does exist, or a higher power or whatever, it's not the sort of thing that most people think it is, whatever it might be. But it definitely isn't a thing where, quote unquote, bad things or good things or success, yes. They don't depend on this God thing, because there's so many good people that are just suffering, and there's so many bad people. Look at Trump and his right. kids. Like, you're right. Going to tell me they're like wonderful people because they're all billionaires and they're just like the bottom of the humanity.
I agree.
They're just horrible. And on the other view, it'd be like, well, they're successful. God must be shining upon them or something. And no, you know, and so definitely I can see where in AA, it'd be misleading to say that you need that, because even outside of AA, that's not what's going on. There's people starving that believe in God. And there might be another thing that comes with it, like a Buddhist peace that maybe comes with believing in God and love people or whatever, but it's not results. It's not like you will get sobriety if you believe in God. It's like you might not, you might just die. So that's the kind of thing that really helped me, where I distanced myself from that old belief and I looked inside, not only but more importantly outside, with other people, like you're saying, like having other people was enough, but also inside, where I'm just trying to think, what's going on here? Can I just hold on? And what do I need to hold on here in this world around me? And it was other people as well, you know, my parents and everybody that supported me.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, I think this has been a great conversation, and thank you very much for doing this. I really appreciate
it. Thanks so much, John.
It's really nice to get to know you. Your story was, like Gabe said, it was insane. No, it was cool. It was good.
Good question for you.
Yeah.
You said that you have other things that you're into outside of AA now. Do you do this podcast, and what kind of other projects?
So I've got this podcast. I'm still involved in the secular AA movement, and I've got another podcast called AA Beyond Belief, which I've been doing for a long time. So I'm kind of involved in that. But I'm kind of what bothers me about that is you're kind of like in the AA culture wars, and I'm sick of that kind of crap. So I was kind of looking for just other recovery methods. And so I got interested in SMART recovery. I just recently completed the facilitator's training for SMART and learned a lot about that. And I'm just interested in just the world of recovery in general and what I see going on. There's a lot of people that are getting sober today who don't get involved in any kind of a formal program, but they're just meeting up on the internet, you know, and there's communities that are forming. And there's just there's a lot more options available today. There's a lot more going on today. And I think that sometimes that we get into silos in the recovery community, just like we get in silos in the real world. And I just wanted to kind of break out of my silo a little bit. And that's why I created this podcast, so I could get and meet people like you. I wouldn't have met you otherwise, or Gabe, and some of the other people I've had on here. So, and that enriches my life. And if it helps someone else, that's all the better. Well, should I play that funky music and end this episode?
Thanks so much, John, and we'll keep in touch.
That's it for another episode of My Secular Sobriety. Thank you again, Danny Castro. We'll definitely stay in touch. And best of luck to you in your career and in your studies. And I guess that will be it.